Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Eddie Packham and we are tickling your ears in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, the final international break of the season is over and we can get on with the very real business of getting our season back on track. Seems like forever since we last kicked a ball in anger, and the players will be itching to end the run of six successive defeats. And it's a great opportunity to do it, with bottom side Norwich coming to the Amex this week. Until you realise we've not beaten a side in the bottom three at the last six attempts. Although we haven't seen our team in action of late, there are plenty of players who've been on international duty, and we will have eyes on many of them in November's World Cup. In other news, the club has announced the accounts for the year and the headline news that we are losing £1 million a week. And joining me to discuss all that is, of course, Alan Wares. And we are delighted to welcome back a man who always brightens up any day. It's author, musician and journalist, Nick Schrapanik. Welcome back, Nick. You're looking fabulous. Your hair's looking beautiful, I have to say.
It's slightly uncontrolled, and it's enjoying its best life at the moment. Slightly separate from the rest of my head, by the look of it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a funny old time, isn't it? With six defeats in a row.
Same as Norwich.
And it's got to give then.
Well, something does have to give, and you know, with Norwich actually, you know, needing the results more than we do, then you know, a draw is probably enough. I mean, I'm still not overly worried about looking over our shoulder because, you know, as long as we can start keeping the scoreboard ticking over, yes, 3 points would be great. But I think what I'm most concerned about isn't necessarily what's happening within the club, is the reaction to it. Now, there's a lot of concern from people outside the club and what have you, but it's the whole notion that they believe they know exactly what's going wrong. And yet, seeing as it's almost like it's a secretive club, but they do keep a lot of things, as they should, behind closed doors, that we don't actually know what's going wrong. Now, we've got Dan Burner has now left us, and Dan Ashworth is twiddling his thumbs and getting his fingers green. But I don't necessarily put that down to the two of those two things, you know, sort of accounting for the season's wheels falling off. I just think it is one of those things at the moment, Nick.
At the risk of sounding a bit, you know, a bit sort of swotty, I did look at the seven wins and see what the common factors were. And I think you'll find Adam Lallana started six of the seven, as did Adam Webster. And I think the absence of those two fit and raring to go has been a factor. I mean, you look at people talk about Dan Burn. Well, he was in a good vein of form, you know, just before he was sold. But I think he started one of those games. And, you know, I think there's been a bit of a sort of rewriting of history to say what a great and a completely irreplaceable player Dan Burn was. People weren't saying that before Christmas. In fact, you know, he wasn't playing and his absence wasn't really noticed.
No. I mean, that is a major factor, and one that we've highlighted many times over this run as well. I mean, the fact that not just that, we haven't actually been able to pick our first choice of defence at all during this run. I mean, we've had Lewis Dunk injured and suspended. We've had Adam Webster consistently injured. We've had Duffy coming in and out and having being everything in one game. But at the end of the day, the problem lies at the front of the pitch, and we're not creating as many chances as we were, and we're not scoring enough goals. Are we obviously keeping a clean sheet first? You go onto the pitch with a point.
Yeah, but
as has been said before, it's the front of the pitch and slightly behind the front of the pitch. You know, a complete absence of goals from Gross, Lallana, Bissouma, March, at least one other midfield player. Moda. I might go out on a limb and say that tomorrow Jakub Moda will score his first league goal for the Albion to celebrate Poland going through gloriously to the World Cup finals. But that's just in more in hope than expectation. You know that normally, you know, when I go as a spectator, I don't actually see Albion players score. But I believe tomorrow is going to be the change to those fortunes.
It's our best opportunity. But my point is always the fact that, all right, it's been six games and over, what, maybe a couple of months. But for all the conversation that we had before Christmas of us chasing a European place, that to 2 months later, that, you know, we're seriously looking at relegation, and seriously looking over our shoulder at being sucked into the relegation draw. You don't become a rubbish team overnight. It takes a while to become a rubbish team. So the whole notion of there's something clearly, obviously wrong at the club. No, there's clearly something wrong with the team, absolutely. But there's this inherent, I don't know, this toxin, this virus, whatever it is that's going through the club.
A rat in the camp putting a spanner in the works.
That's the one, yes. With
season, I don't think there's anything wrong with the club at all.
I don't think there is at all. But, you know, everyone has to come up with a reason as to why it is. And you know, the whole Dan Ashworth saga. And, well, actually, Dan Ashworth is operating at a different end to what's going on the pitch. You know,
he's an administrator.
This is a squad that's capable of winning games. Mm-hmm. It showed it. At the moment, it isn't doing so. It's misfiring. It will come good.
Have we become a little bit too predictable? I mean, that is something that has been levelled at us, and maybe that's
by
correct.
Whom? Hang on, by whom? By people who watch us all the time, rather than those who don't. We know what's coming up because we've seen us play our given way so many times. Yes, we have a variation of it, but those who haven't played against us, I mean, obviously you're going to have the manager, the opposition manager, he's going to work out how he's going to counteract a given play that the Albion might have. But just because we've seen it doesn't mean to say that the other team, A, can know about it, and B, therefore can do anything about it now.
Yeah, but Albert, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're right either. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, everyone...
No, but we all know that
Pascal Gross is going to have... who's got the turning circle of the Titanic, is exactly what he's going to do. He's going to do a cry turn in slow motion, and the defender's going to fall on his backside. It happens every time.
You just proved my point.
We know that's going to happen. But, I mean, one
it still happens.
But I mean, one thing that like we have seen, particularly, I mean, the start of this run, which was actually the FA Cup game at Spurs. Spurs were playing us on the counter attack at home, and basically they exploited the spaces that we were leaving in behind. And since then, we've seen Burnley do that. We've seen Villa do it. It's have we become, which is why I'm wondering. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I'm seeing it
even
being written.
Spurs,
I've seen what you talked about.
Spurs did it at the MXN at White Hart Lane. You know, a low block, get 10 behind the ball. we lumber forward very slowly, and even our central defenders get drawn forward, joining in the attack. And then there's acres and acres of grass behind them. Somebody lobs the ball into it, and we're cut open. Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit concerned, not actually by our performance against with the ball against Burnley, but our performance without the ball. I think everybody in the ground knew what we could expect from Burnley, except the 11 players on the pitch. And, you know, after 20 minutes, you had Lallana going over to Potter and, you know, and trying to suggest some changes. But I was a bit taken aback by that. I actually asked Graham Potter at this week's press conference if he was becoming a bit more conservative as a coach. You know, because I think when he was at Östersunds and at Swansea, you know, he had a reputation for being very innovative and doing slightly wacky things with team selection. I mean, to a certain extent, he does that still. And there's always the guessing game when the teams, you know, the team sheet comes out as to exactly where everybody's playing. But he doesn't do anything as radical as he did at Swansea last season when they or the season before. Well, no, his last season, his only season at Swansea when they. Sorry. I'll start all that again. His only season at Swansea, when they played Man City, and he played a sort of 4-foot-tall midfield player as a sweeper because he knew there wasn't any sort of danger or any aerial attacks from Man City. But, you know, we haven't seen, you know, Lamptey played as a lone forward. We haven't seen, you know, anything completely unusual. But he says he thinks he's always, you know, done unusual things with you know, team positioning, and he's not conscious of it. But, I just wonder whether he feels that some of his... you know, slightly more innovative moves aren't quite for the Premier League.
No, that's the issue about it is that when it works, it can look absolutely wonderful. And when it doesn't, it looks horrific. I mean, the notion of Burnley beating us on the counter-attack, I thought actually they were the ones that hogged the ball. Certainly in the first half, they were the ones that hogged the ball. It wasn't a counter-attacking game they played. They just overran us. Yeah, we play at a high risk, high tempo. Well, not high tempo, but we certainly play a high risk game. And when it works, it can be great. you know, let's forget the finishing aspect of it at the moment. But when it works, it's great. But when it is undone, yeah, teams will start to suss us out. But I think Potter still has enough about him that if a team has sussed us out in a given way, we're still fluid enough that we can sort of alter it. I think that the only issue that I would have at the moment is that we do seem to play better, or certainly the players seem happier when they're in a back five. And at the moment, that doesn't seem to have been so much of an option for him. Now, as much as he's got a reputation for bloodying young kids, he's reluctant to bring in any youngsters to fill a gap within the back five, in which case he'd rather go for the back four.
Against Tottenham, it was a back five when we were defending, wasn't it, with Cucurella playing on the left of the three and March as the left wing back. And when we had the ball, Cucurella became an orthodox left back and Solly March became a left winger. So it's a sort of half of five and half of four, depending on whether we're attacking or defending in some games.
So it's kind of four and a half.
Yeah.
Three and a half, four and a half. 2-1.
But this goes back to what I was saying earlier. I mean, this run has coincided with the fact that we haven't been able to pick our first choice defence for, well, this year, pretty much.
Yeah, so the whole notion of a malaise at the club, which some people are talking about, with absolutely zero evidence, also say, I think has absolutely no validity.
The other thing is, Nick, that this is the point, and we've made this several times, but the thing with Adam Webster is the way that he brings the ball out allows everyone else to play 10 yards further up the pitch and open up more space and runs for other players.
And he's also a provider of goals.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when we won at Watford, Webster scored. Draw against Chelsea, Webster scored.
Our last two goals, Nick, were scored by Adam Webster.
Yeah.
So,
well, apart from Lewis Dunk's header at Newcastle.
Well, this is true, actually. The last goal at home.
What are the rest of the team doing?
The last goal at home and the last goal at...
in a win.
Yeah.
So by that reckoning, the last three goals have been scored by centre-backs, and that says something about... Because, I mean, the unusual thing is that... And this is what slightly changed, is that we're not creating the chances. Now, the most recent game that we had, we still lost. You know, the reluctance... The almost psychotic reluctance to get the ball into the middle from out wide, which they did try and then do for the first part of the second half. You know, there was this whole notion of being so slow, of trying to walk the ball in. You know, that we either have to score spectacular goals in order to open up the other team, or one day we will be able to just walk it in, which is, I think, what the preferred version is. But whatever it is just too slow at the front. And then even when the opportunity does raise its head, then someone will tread on the ball or they'll, you know, and then you'll still...
I think that the ball driven along the six-yard box has brought two of my favourite Amex goals of all time. The own goal by Lucas Digne for Everton, the own goal by that Watford right-back as well.
Yes.
I mean, nothing beats a defender coming in and thrashing the ball high into the roof of the North Stand net from a hard low cross, and if the crosses don't come in, you're even denied that possibility.
Absolutely, but this is a conversation we've had many, many times. So let's just hope, AD, that we can move on.
Well, we are playing the team with by far the worst defence in the Premier League tomorrow.
Well,
Nick, I mean, not by stretch.
There's three teams that have only scored 10 goals at home, and I think the other two are in the bottom three.
Yeah, but Nick, the Brighton way is to lose to Norwich and beat Arsenal, though, isn't it?
As long as we beat somebody, yeah. If you could promise me that, now I'd take it.
We're more likely to do that.
To be honest, Andy, okay, gun to head. Just quickly a question then before we move on. How many more points do you think we need to actually stop worrying?
I don't think we need any more points. If you look at, obviously we want more points and hopefully we'll get more points, but the figure that teams have been relegated on in the last 4 or 5 years, it's been around the 32 to 35 point mark the last. So you're saying
we probably do need some more points.
Yes, we do.
We're on 31 now.
We're on 33.
So yeah, at least another 2 points.
Yeah, I'd say one win and two draws ought to be enough. That's 5 points.
But yeah, I mean it's a worrying trend, but the thing is, we also to put a positive spin on it, It's been a long break. The players have had time to work on it. We know that someone like Neil Morpay, we know his goals tend to come in streaks. They score five in a row and then not score for 10 games.
Actually, Nick, did you say that you attended Potter's presser this week?
Yeah.
Did he mention about the fact that he believed that he'd had some really good sessions with the players during, you know, since the last game?
He said it had been the best international break because they'd got some of the under 23s in to work with, and you know they'd done some good sessions and he'd learned about some of the under 23 players. I mean, he's already had Ferguson in the squad and some of the others, so I'm not quite sure what he still needed to know, but maybe some of the others. You know, that we see on those Friday evening videos from Lansing, that maybe he hadn't had such a close look. He also said, and I'm looking for the quote, which I got. He said, it's not rocket science that we've got to attack better. So that has been something that we have thought about and spoken about. Well, that's a start, isn't it? I would have thought.
They've acknowledged it.
We've done a few drills and a bit of shooting practice as well, but at least they're talking about it and thinking about it. And that's, you know, that is admitting you've got a problem is the first step on in the way to solving it, isn't it?
And the next thing is just doing something about it, I think is...
Mm-hmm. Oh, come on, Rome wasn't built in a day.
Okay, well, sorry.
And Leo Trossard, you know, he's got one goal and two assists for Belgium this week, you know, muscle memory and all that. Hopefully he'll remember how to do it again.
Well, it was against the might of Burkina Faso, wasn't it? So
you can only beat what's
probably about a level with Norwich. So fair enough.
But okay, I mean, before we move on for that, obviously there is going to be a change from next season. The five subs thing is coming back. There's been a lot of discussion about that. Some people say it favours teams with more expensive squads, but it's certainly a rule change that Brighton did vote for, Nick. So,
well, but the Albion used the five subs more on more occasions than any other team.
Did during lockdown, yeah.
So obviously they're going to, and we've got, you know, a lot of those interchangeable midfield players to fit in somewhere or other. So I'm not surprised. But interesting, I was at Thomas Tuchel's press conference today, and he said that it was a good move. and if he had been in charge of one of the lower half teams, he would have voted it, because he says it gives the chance to keep the team fresh if you're playing one of the bigger teams and keep the intensity going. Easy for him to say, you know, from a man who's in charge of probably the third best squad in the Premier League. But he seemed to think it was not just something that favours the big teams. I mean, let's be honest, you know, everyone's got big squads these days. I mean, I don't buy all this, oh, you know, it benefits the big clubs. Everyone wants to get, you know, games into all their squad. And every Premier League team, you know, bar a couple, has got, you know, benches full of reasonably big names. Certainly, you know, even, you know, going to play teams like Everton and Watford, you know, they've got... Mm. You know, they've got big names on the bench and big names not even in the squad. And I think it's people have suggested that two of the players should be academy graduates, if not actually homegrown players. But I'm not sure how you do that. I mean, if you use your first three subs and they're not, does that mean your last two have got to be? So you might be putting yourself in a hole there. It'd be an interesting tactical.
Now, the thing about what is with the Albion is when they name their nine subs at the moment, and this is where probably we are slightly not quite replete with the full squad that we need to have, is that of those nine, you know that about four or five of them have no chance of getting on, especially when it's three from nine. And I'm especially thinking of the under-23s. So if you have a bench that's going to have the senior players and then three or four, maybe five, of the juniors or the under-23s, the likelihood of them getting on is going to be slim. Now, from five from nine, they've got a better chance of getting on, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But you also know full well that Graham Potter is going to favour those five senior players to use first. So in that sense, because you're only using five, ideally any given manager will want five from five. Mm. If they're going to have a big squad, then that means they're not going to bring the under-23s through, which... in itself could have its own repercussions. I mean, don't get me wrong, when you're talking about Man City, Chelsea, Liverpool, what have you, and they've got millions upon millions of pounds worth of talent on their bench, then, you know, any given manager is going to have that option, and they're going to have that that delight of talents going for them. But if they've got what, for instance, Graham Potter has at the moment, which is half first team regulars and half juniors, then it's not actually going to make a huge difference until such time as the squad itself is replete with more seniors.
Well, when we've got have all the loan players coming back next year, then obviously it might give us more of an option to keep more of them at the club, specifically with the rule changes coming up. But I mean, and also just going back to your earlier point there, Al, I mean, when you look at a side, and I think this is actually a good thing, and I'm sure Nick will probably agree with me, is the fact that if you look at a side like Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp does actually give a lot of the bench is actually full of a lot of their younger talent, and he does actually give them an opportunity to do so. But
yeah, also, I mean, there is an argument, isn't there, for the using the last couple of bench spots to give a bit of a taste of Premier League atmosphere to somebody from the under 23s or even the 18s. So I think most clubs, you know, if you look down the bottom of those benches, there's probably somebody you've only heard of very briefly, or somebody who'll be there for the day out, but you know, just to see what goes on at first team level.
Yeah, and also the other thing is, with this rule change, I mean, it would deprive us of seeing our best goalkeeper this season.
What, Lewis Dunk?
Lewis Dunk, clean sheet. Only goalkeeper to play this season in the first team to keep his clean sheet.
Anyway, no, I think the fact is that irrespective of what fans think of it, if the managers, I'm not even talking about the clubs, if the managers are in favour of it. And, you know, the conversation that they'd have had at the top of the Albion, where, you know, Tony and Paul and what have you would have actually had the conversation with him saying, what do you think, Graham? And then Graham's going to say, yes, I'm in favour of it. Please vote that way. Assuming that everyone does actually face the same direction, it's not really for us to actually criticise anything about it. You know, we used it reasonably well during lockdown, and, you know, fine. I the only thing I don't know is that are they going to do it the same way as before, where they've got to do it in a maximum of three goes?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Right.
I think it's three goes plus an extra one at halftime. So basically you can do it in tranches of during game time.
Yeah,
it's tranches of three, but you can do it at half time as well.
Fine, but okay.
Well, let's move on for that. And you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. And the show is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And those wide eared people of you will have noticed Phil appearing on our friends, the Albion Unlimited show this week. Nice. Interestingly, that they didn't mention oldfootballshirts.com once on that show, but we will do it plenty of times here.
Yeah. You know the other thing about Albion Unlimited as well, mate? Neither you or I have been on it yet. Thanks, Johnny.
You have, actually.
I have no recollection of this whatsoever.
Yes, you made an appearance at Christmas, I believe.
Hey, help me out here. I have no recollection of this.
Unfortunately, I do. I've got a long memory. We'll have a word with Johnny about that. Anyway, we have got a shirt of the week for you, and this is a particular jersey for Nick to describe. Any ideas what this is, Nick?
I've got a sort of it rings a bell, but it doesn't make sense if you see what I mean. Just to describe it, it's blue with a sort of jacquard pattern of diagonal lighter stripes, and then some rather alarming exaggerated chevrons on the sleeve and some very, very big white cuffs. It sort of looks as if it's like a Porto training top or something. So I'm thinking Portuguese. The not very well blanked out sponsor looks like the Porto sponsor. So I don't know if it's a...
Well, everything about it screams the fact he's tried to Photoshop the badge, and it's Porto's badge. In the kind of the watermark within the shirt says FCP.
Oh, does it?
I mean, it's a plain blue shirt as opposed to Porto's kit, which is blue and white stripes. And let's face it, not every club that wears blue and white stripes historically stays in that colours. So, but I think everything about it does scream training top. So I think me and Nick are in agreement here, AD. It's a Porto training top.
Well, that's where you're wrong. This is the 95 shirt of a sporting club, the Lisbon. No, it's, no, you're right. It's Porto. It is Porto.
It's only two April Fools until midday, mate.
This is the 95-96 European Cup shirt of Portuguese Giants FC Porto. Nicknamed the Dragons, they play at the 50,033 capacity Estadio de Dragão in the northwestern coastal city of Porto. The team was formed in 1893 as Football Club do Porto by a local port wine restaurant. Antonio Nicolau Almeida, who was an avid sports enthusiast and became fascinated with football during trips to England. And their first match was against FC Lisbonés in March 1894, when King Carlos I and Queen Amélie of Orléans watched the game and handed out the trophy. Porto almost disappeared around 1900 when interest in the club waned. But in 1906, a group of locals, again inspired by the English game, pulled the side out of the doldrums, and the rest, they say, is history. Porto won the first ever Portuguese national title in 1921, and since then have gone on to win the title 29 more times. In addition, they have 43 domestic club trophies and 5 European trophies. Defender João Pinto holds the record for most appearances with the side, playing 587 times between 81 and 97. And Fernando Gomes holds the record for most goals scored, 352. 352 goals!
What's the goal?
Exactly. It's exactly what I was going to say. And that was between 1974 and 1989. When Andre Villas-Boas was manager, he became the youngest ever coach to win a European competition, the 2010-11 UEFA Cup. And there are a few links to the UK, of course. Luis Diaz, the ever popular Liverpool forward, made 124 appearances for Porto before moving to Merseyside. Man United's Alexis Telles played 129 for them in Portugal before moving to Old Trafford. Add to them Benny McCarthy, Ricardo Carvalho, and Nicola Otamendi, and you can see how the Premier League has attracted some half-decent players from Porto over the years. And of course, there are a few Albion links. Way back in 2014, João Teixeira joined us on loan from Liverpool and was voted the Young Player of the Year after a cracking season with us. Bringing you right up to date, Benicio Baker Boaty signed on loan in January with a view to a permanent move, and he's playing for the under-23s or on loan to Belgium or something. Who knows, says Phil. No, he is with the 23s, Phil.
Are we talking about the same... Jose Mourinho as well, who was their manager.
Yes, he was
very interesting. Nice, always nice to see a team in blue and white stripes and blue shorts winning leagues. And the Estadio de Dragão is a bit Amex-y, actually, but with sort of big open ends.
You've been there, haven't you?
I was about to say, Nick, have you been to the Dragão yet?
Yeah. I was in a hotel almost next to the stadium, oddly enough, when Portsmouth were playing in Guimarães, about 30 miles away. But no, I've seen Chelsea play there.
Yes.
It's a very impressive stadium. But, you know, like a sort of the Amex and half again.
Yeah, it is. I went to... I went to Euro 2004 and I saw the Netherlands against Germany in the Dragão. And obviously the stadium was brand new at the time, but I was absolutely blown away. And for the number of stadiums I've ever been to, I'd still say it is my all-time favourite. Mm. It is, like I say, the Amex's big brother. Mm. It's absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's now, 18 years old now, so it's possibly worn in a little bit. But I found it absolutely beautiful. It's there. It is on the top of the hill. I mean, Porto itself is a beautiful city.
Oh, beautiful! Yeah, very, very under-recognized, I think, by people who go to Portugal. No, it's very sort of spectacular location, and lots of interesting stuff to see.
Absolutely. Now, when we went to Porto, we also went to Boa Vista's ground, which was terrifying. Mm. That was kind of an enlarged Loftus Road. We saw Spain against Greece for that, including a very young Vicente playing. But every time someone sort of did something and jumped around, the entire stand shook. So if you can imagine four just sort of like equal sheds, a la Loftus Road, but bigger. Mm. And actually, you mentioned Guimarães. I saw Italy against Bulgaria there and Christian Vieri, who couldn't head for toffee, missed the 50p head. So I had a great time in Portugal 2004. It was absolutely superb. But if you're talking about the Dragao, then yes, my all-time favourite stadium.
Of course, that's the World Cup minnows, Italy, who aren't going to the World Cup. But we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, we've got a notice board. We've got a couple of big things coming up.
We do. And I've got something else to throw into the mix as well. We've got two matches coming up. One's at the end of this month. Croydon FC is hosting Crystal Palace fans against Brighton fans in the first leg of the Robert E. Memorial Fund Trophy. It'd be great if you could all come along. And hopefully even outnumber the Palace fans. They're getting involved in it as well. So if you fancy coming along, it's just head to East Croydon and then take the tram six stations eastwards, jump off at a place called Arena, and you are there at the Croydon Sports Arena, home of Croydon FC. So that's the Friday, the 29th of April, 7:45 kickoff, a fiver to get in. The second leg is a month later, 27th of May, at Sussex FA HQ, Culver Road, Lancing. Let's just hope that the first leg doesn't end up 9-0, which would be a wrong'un. But I'm also going to throw
in a bit like the Renth game last year, Al.
Yes, that kind of thing, where they 8-1 Barnston Worth United, it was, wasn't it?
Barnston Worth?
I'm not going to say it because it's rude.
Agatier.
Yeah. It won.
Bloody won.
I wasn't going to say that, Nick. Thank you.
I love scrap.
And the other thing to throw in there is that the club is commemorating 25 years since the end of the Goldstone, and there are various things coming up, including a Legends dinner on the 22nd of April. But what I'm hosting is... on Friday the 6th of May in Dick's Bar is a Goldstone 25th quiz night. It wouldn't be me hosting anything if it wasn't a quiz night. So if you remember your Albion history since 1997, do form yourself a team, get together. It's going to be £15 per person. That includes a free pie and pint. All the proceeds go to, or there is split between the Albion and the community and the Ukraine Disaster Emergency Committee. So did pop along. Teams of up to six. And if you wish to take part, email goldstone25quiz@gmail.com. That's goldstone25, that's the number 25, goldstone25quiz@gmail.com. Teams of up to six. So it'd be great if you could come along and support one Albion in the community and obviously the Ukraine Disaster Fund as well. There'll be other things going on. Listen out for them. But those are the things that are going on. They involve us.
Okay. Well, today we're recording this on Friday. So today, the World Cup draw has been made. And it's...
Couldn't have been a better day to have done it on April Fool's Day, could it?
Well, this is true. But I mean, there's going to be lots of Albion involvement, hopefully, in November. I mean, let's face it. I mean, we've just coming out off the back of an international break. I mean, everybody hates an international break. It's just ridiculous. And this, what it's a World Cup, which I don't think an awful lot of people have got an awful lot of time for, Nick, have they?
No, I'm dead against it being where it is. I think the whole process was so corrupt. It even amazed Sepp Blatter, who I believe had been persuaded to vote for the United States, and even he couldn't believe it when Qatar came out. And of course, the thing is that the whole thing was done under completely false pretenses. They promised that they could air condition all the stadiums so that it wouldn't be necessary to move the whole calendar around. And then they said they couldn't do it, at which point it should have been taken away from them. It should never have gone to them in the first place, but there was a chance to take it away, and that wasn't used. So we've got this ridiculous 6-week international break for the World Cup. And I will watch it, but I won't watch it with much enthusiasm.
It's going to be a funny old time. I mean, the fact is that the sports fans within us, and let's face it, this country has, you know, a multitude, millions upon millions of avid sports fans. And the whole notion of what was Qatar, was it 3-4 hours ahead of us? So the whole notion of us getting up for the 2 o'clock matches, if they're going to have 2 o'clock matches, which is completely bomb.
Actually, the kickoff times are actually all right, actually.
There are four scheduled kickoff times, I think, the first one being 10 o'clock in the morning.
And the latest one is 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah. So, right. So they're not our time or their time?
Our time.
Right. I was about to say.
And don't forget, we had the breakfast kickoffs when the World Cup was in Japan and South Korea. But
no, it's not that. 10 o'clock. Sorry, it's not that. I was just thinking, if there was a 2 o'clock kickoff in Qatar, then you know, mad dogs and Englishmen. But yeah, yes, we will get excited about it eventually. You know, there's always some political worry about a given World Cup. It's just knowing full well that the political concern was actually completely internal. You know, once upon a time, when it was concerned they were going to hold it in Russia, when even back in the 70s, when they were going to hold it in Argentina, and all the political nonsense involved in that. But yeah, I'm sure that, you know, Sod's Law says that it's going to be an okay World Cup. But the raison d'etre, the how we got to where we are, is just a horrible, horrible
story. But you say it's going to be an okay World Cup, and I think there was Miguel Delaney of The Independent wrote this week that, you know, having been over there, all the World Cup stadiums are within an area the size of Greater Dublin. You know, all of the fans are not going to be spread out, you know, different. There's not going to be any interesting, unusual cities to see. There's not going to be any interesting tourism things. Everything's essentially in Greater Doha, you know, and the fans are all going to be milling around among one another.
Really?
What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, how many are going to go out there, given, you know, especially if you consider Western lifestyles? How many are going to go out there? You can't drink, you can't.
Well, they have said that alcohol will be available, but obviously they're saying alcohol will be available, but you have to respect the local.
What could go wrong?
Like,
I'm sorry,
the local culture to a certain degree, but I mean, the politics of this, the whole thing is wrong. We know that their human rights record is wrong. We know that.
I mean, it's not as though you should actually ban it from Muslim countries. If the alcohol thing is an issue, to actually ban it from Muslim countries is absolutely wrong, and one shouldn't do that. So the whole banning of alcohol is neither here nor there. But we're talking about, you know...
Aren't the England wags going to be staying in a liner moored offshore where they can drink? Did I read that, or did I make that up? Did I dream it?
I don't know, but whatever it is that... It's one thing respecting local customs, but it's also, if they really want to actually, you know, extend their own PR and be part of the world stage, they've got to acknowledge that actually the rest of the world stage has its stuff as well. It has its culture. You know, so there's got to be give and take on all sides here. Yeah. And if the Qataris aren't prepared to do that, then, you know, what are they doing in the World Cup in the first place?
Well, yeah, the rights and wrongs of what it is. I mean, unfortunately, it's happening.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it represents a very good opportunity for England to actually win the thing. I mean, England going to a World Cup in a place that nobody wants to go to, and a boycotting because of their thing. But, you know, I mean, to give you some reasons to try and get excited about it, let's talk about Panini stickers. And these are the players that you could connect Panini stickers of. You could have one of Robert Sanchez, Leandro Trossard, Jakub Mona, Kasper Kozlowski, Karim Mitoma, Cachido, Sarmiento.
Sorry, AD.
Yeah.
Nick.
Yes.
Yeah, I know my pronoun.
Could you tell let AD know how Kasper's surname is pronounced?
Kozlowski.
Get a Panini sticker of him.
Warren Aspinall's pronunciation of it was epic.
Yeah. Go on.
But, you know, you could have a sticker with Alexis McAllister on it. Joel Veltman, Andy Zakiri, Chris Hughton.
Well, no, the game of the tournament so far is Ali Mack against Moda, isn't it? When Argentina play Poland. That's the one I've got penciled in already. Nothing else matters in that first round, in that group stage.
It is kind of interesting. That's not to say that, you know, by the time, because it's not during the summer, by that time there might even be more going to be added to the carousel.
Possibly.
You know, it's, I mean, that is, to be honest, the delicious one, Ali Mack against Jakub Moda. But we've also got the possibility of Sanchez against Mitoma, however that's spelled. I'm looking at the draw here, which did come across as a bit of a farce. I mean, our draw is, as the Guardian put it, is the group of diplomacy. So we've got Iran, USA, and possibly Ukraine.
Scotland or Wales?
Yeah, well, that's the point, isn't it? I mean, Nick, can you see it at the moment how Ukraine are going to be able to fulfil their fixtures?
The players are going to have to play abroad, aren't they? I mean, because, don't forget that the Shakhtar Donetsk haven't been playing in their home stadium for a very long time. So, you know, they've been exiled clubs in the Ukrainian league, so there's going to be an exiled country. I mean, I suppose they would have to get, you know, the Ukrainian players who haven't gone home to join up. And I don't know what would be the right sort of country to play in.
Well, the logic for me would actually dictate that if they've got to play Scotland or Wales next, that they actually have it in this country, and then they don't have to go too far for their next game.
Yeah, I mean, would they not want something like home advantage if they were due it in the first place? Mind you, they were supposed to play in Russia, weren't they?
Yeah, could they do it in Poland? Could they do it in Romania?
I mean, they could certainly play it at the National Stadium in Warsaw. That would be fine. I mean, there'd obviously be some sort of, be lots of support for them there.
You mentioned Shakhtar there. I mean, they've played about as many games at home in recent years as the Harlem Globetrotters.
Well, they were playing in Lviv, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, the story with this thing goes long and hard, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah. So, I mean,
it's almost as if football wasn't the most important thing in the world at the moment.
Who knew? No. Who knew?
But so, of course, the point is that they have to play. They presume they have to sort, or these games have to be decided. Even if they decide they can't play, and they have to be given, you know, that Scotland get a bye. But you know, it's got to be decided by a certain time, hasn't it?
Do you know what that deadline is?
I think it's June, isn't it? I think I'm pretty sure it's June. They're basically they're saying there's a date in June in the calendar for it at the moment. I don't know if that is actually a infinite deadline for it, but at the end of the day, I mean, the longer this war goes on, I mean, obviously that's the most important thing here. I mean, we can laugh and joke about it, but people are losing their lives about this whole thing at the moment. So,
of course,
like as Nick says, it's not the most important thing. But let's just hope that Ukraine do get an opportunity to play the game and doing something they love. But and if it is by hopefully if it is in June, then hopefully this whole debacle can be over and they can get back to some sort of normality. But
yeah, whatever way you cut it, that, you know, because. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that it's not just Ukrainians, but anyone in any given country that, you know, even when you're war-torn, there's so many people look to football for solace. You know, it can be such a kind of a unifying pastime, you know, all right, apart from the Central American war between Honduras and El Salvador that fired up, but let's not go there too far. But
and the fact that some people say that the Balkans were all kicked off because of a Dinamo Zagreb Red Star Belgrade game, but
well, let's not go too far down that road. But let's
as they say, it's the most important unimportant thing in the world.
Yeah, no, it's but the point is that, you know, for let's look at the football actually, the tournament itself, and the draw is, I mean, I say we will end up eventually getting excited for it. It's because it's 6 months away. And it kicks our, you know, splats our season in half, or splats all of Europe's season in half, and therefore creates its own sort of little mess. But here we are against the Iran and USA, who are teams that, frankly, should be beatable. But anyone, you remember that game?
Was it like USA, Al?
Was it in Germany, Nick, that game against USA where Robert Green made his dropsy?
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was in South Africa, wasn't it?
Was it? I lose track of rubbish England performances.
I think it was in South Africa. But, and this is not a great United States team. You know, they were by no means certain to qualify. You've got Christian Pulisic. They got a few decent players, but they're not the team they were.
Right.
So, you know, I think it really would be a major shock if we didn't beat them. No, I mean, that's a group England, you know, should walk out of, really.
But yeah. Is it the Canadians?
How many times have we said that?
the Canadians are actually a team to watch, featuring a former Albion player, of course.
Adekugbe,
yeah.
All right, okay.
We'll get excited about it as and when we do. But okay, well let's move on from the World Cup, because it's like, you know, there's so many rights and wrongs about it. We know what's going to happen. We'll look forward to seeing the Albion players being involved. Of course, we hate the timing of it. Like I said, it's just a really long international break, and I hate international breaks. But it just robs it. I mean, the fact that the season is going to be.
Amy, can I put this to you then, in that case? You just said you hate international breaks. Do you not think that actually this time round we needed one this last week or so?
Well, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it, isn't there? There's one, it gives you a chance to regroup and get back to it, or it also gives you a chance that the players will want to get out there and put it right as soon as possible. Because we have, like you said earlier, we haven't become a bad team overnight. We just want to. Apart from the Burnley game and maybe the Villa game, we've always been in the game, but those were just aberrations. And
it was interesting because Potter in his press conference said that the Burnley game had knocked the confidence so badly that it was still carrying on into the Villa game.
Yeah,
and you'd kind of hope they'd be a little more resilient than that by now. But I was looking forward to this international break because I was confidently expecting it would be a chance to get Lallana and Webster fit, but that doesn't seem to have happened.
So and according to, was it your stats or AD's stats, those are the games that we've won when those two have started. Yeah. So
I mean, also Mope started them and Trossard started them, but I think, you know, if you're looking for significant absences, I think those two. You know, Lallana's leadership and Webster's sort of dynamic defending and ability to carry the ball forward.
Yeah, but one player that is back is, and this is a massive plus point, and he's had a good international break as well, which is Ina Mwepu. He went away with Zambia, captained his side for the first time and scored as well.
Yeah, helps. It all helps. We just want to make sure that he's actually sort of match ready for us. Actually, the point you're making about Lallana and Webster actually reminds me, and you'll remember this, AD, certainly during lockdown, is that Lallana and Webster are clearly the noisiest people as well on the pitch.
This is very true.
Webster particularly. I think that Mwepu, we haven't seen uninterrupted runs of him in the team, but, you know, he brings a certain of enthusiasm, doesn't he?
And his first ball is forward.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that pass he played for Trossard to score against Brentford on Boxing Day, wasn't it? Or Boxing Night.
Yes.
One of the great passes of this season.
And that little flick for McAllister's second at Everton.
Yeah.
He does bring something to the team, absolutely. But it's a case of, you know, because he's... All right, he's done well for Zambia. Good, that's brilliant. But, you know, he's now getting into the Premier League, back into the Premier League again. And, you know, it's... Even from an international point of view, you know, there's still a step up you have to make to perform well in the Premier League. So and it's his first game back in the Premier League for what is it, 3-4 months now?
Yeah, true. Yeah. All right. Well, okay. Well, let's move on. It's time to get a little bit misty eyed and at the time of recording this, which is the 1st of April, it marks the 25th anniversary of the last ever floodlit game at the Goldstone Grounds. Now, we put something out on social media today, and a few people have come up with their favourite floodlit games memories. Quite a few of them at the Goldstone. But Nick, I mean, there was always something about, you know, just getting off at home station and seeing the sky illuminated and leading the way like a.
Oh, well, see, those of us who lived on the other side of the Goldstone from home station, it was slightly different. We were walking along the old Shoreham Road, you know, from the other direction and see the lights on, you know, and the floodlights over the North Stand. Now, I remember there was, in the 71-72 promotion season, a lot of the significant games were midweek games, you know, when we'd be losing 1-0 with 10 minutes to go and turn it around. And I remember there was an amazing game against Rotherham. I think we scored the winner for 10 minutes of injury time. But there was one game... I'm probably the only person that remembers this. On a very sort of misty midweek evening against Bristol Rovers, and the sort of fog was, closing the ground in, and the roar just seemed to stay inside the Goldstone. I think we won 3-1. I think Willie Irvine scored. And there was a couple of League Cup ties against Wolves. Great evening.
Yeah, we've got a few memories of that, actually. Just trying to find the League Cup game versus Wolves, 1969, says Paul Forrest.
Yeah, that was the days when people 35,000 people rolls there. When you scored. And I remember the North Stand goal being almost invisible behind toilet rolls that had been thrown in there, I think, after Eddie Spirit scored.
But I mean, Paul Forrest, he says, League Cup versus Forrest around 69, he thinks. 35,000 people there. We're in Div 3. Wolves were in Division 1. We lost 3-2 thanks to a goal from Hugh Curran, who's someone I've never heard of.
Dave Woodfield, actually, but there you go.
But he says, but what an amazing atmosphere in the North Stand. Graham Hollibon, my first game was under the lights was Notts County in 31st of January 78. You could see the stadium lights glowing as you came over the downs into Brighton. And some bloke called Alan Wares, he said, when leaving the ground, trying to get my circulation going again in my toes after standing for 2 hours in the North Stand. We've got a few of these, but wasn't that the famous Walsall game? That was a midweek game at the Golds.
It was, yes, that's right. And we just thought at halftime, oh my God, you know, we've been kicking up towards the North Stand. You know, what's going to happen? We're going to be playing into the wind. It's going to be a disaster. 0-0 at halftime. And then, seven goals down the hill. That was another great one. I mean, there's been some good stuff at the Amex as well. You think of the Manchester United victory.
You know, and with Dean as well, but I just want to go back to the Goldstone again quickly, then, Nick, because our good friend Marcus Hancock to remind me of this one, which was a game. It was the game we went to Anfield and drew 2-2 in the FA Cup, the game where John Crumplin had John Barnes in his pocket, but the replay back at the Goldstone. What a game that was. And we lost it in extra time eventually 3-2, to the Steve McMahon goal. But I mean, we absolutely, it was end to end stuff, hammer and tongs. It was amazing.
Yeah, Mike Small and Johnny Byrne. God, what wouldn't we like a couple of strikers like that?
I mean, the main thing I remember, the great thing I remember about any given floodlit game at the Goldstone was the floodlights themselves. I mean, there's no modern stadiums these days. Correct me if I'm wrong. No modern stadiums have floodlighting pylons anymore. I mean, they didn't actually worry too much about lighting pollution back in those days. And the Goldstone would light up the entire area for miles around. And even then, as bright as they were, when you saw them on the telly, you think, couldn't they turn them up a little bit more? You know, they didn't seem to worry. Sometimes you could just about see what was going on. And I'm thinking probably in terms of modern day lighting now, even at the Amex, they completely reinstalled every single floodlight when we got promoted to the Premier League, because they weren't the entire vista wasn't bright enough. And the difference, you could see the difference when we played our first floodlight game. In the Premier League, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and they were very, very dull, weren't they, in the Championship? I mean, sometimes if you... Well, when we all used to sit in the West Stand upper, you know, stuff going on in the touchline in the East was, you know, you could barely make it out sometimes.
Yeah, it did seem to be that the floodlights didn't highlight the East Stand touchline, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously everything is completely different now. And how we actually managed to get night games on it with Dean, because of those, you know, sort of four candles.
No, the Dagenham and Redbridge game, yes. You know, played in front of a couple of kilowatt bulbs and a Manchester City Cup tie. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, the
that
City
has
goalkeeper
been mentioned
probably
a few
didn't
times.
Even see the player running up to the penalty spot until he was almost on the ball.
But, you know, I mean, the floodlights are with Dean, though. I mean, this is a weird thing to say, but it was almost like it added a roof, because the atmosphere at night games with Dean always seemed to be a little bit livelier. It might because people had more chance to go to the pub, maybe, but it always seemed to be something about, you know, that playoff semi against Swindon. The Man United game, you said when the pitch invasion was led by someone in the mobility scooter, it was
that Rochdale game, though, don't forget, played in the monsoon conditions. That was a night game as well.
I was just about to say that it only seemed to rain hard at night. It could be wrong. I mean, you could have come gone
that
there
wrong.
During the
that
day.
Is but... very definitely wrong. I can remember. We've said it many times before, Al. With Deemers, the only stadium we can get sunstroke and pleurisy at the same time. It
yeah,
was
but
like,
the really rainy games were the night ones. And like I said, the Rochdale one that Nick just mentioned, there was the Swindon game.
Bradford, Millwall, those were games that during the day were absolutely horrendous. I mean, there was a reason they gave us those ponchos, Al.
Yeah, I never did grab one. So yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing. So what do we have? That means then, if that was, well, you say the last game was, so those, there was floodlights at the Goldstone for just 36 years. That's all it was, from 1961 to 1997.
I once turned them on, you know.
But you mean as in you flicked a switch rather?
Yeah,
than
no, basically, I've probably told this story before, but back in the days, I used to be a ball boy at the Goldstone. I one of the guys who used to look after us there, I mean, obviously Keith Cuss. Actually, it's the anniversary of his header today as well. But it was, we had him on the show. If you've missed that, it was back in our archives from a few weeks ago. But yeah, I mean, apart from Keith Cuss, who used to look after us, the fabulous Jock Riddell used to look after us. Yeah. And I used to love Jock. And I just remember, hey, you want to turn on the floodlights? And like, he took me into this room. There's this great big board of switches. And I just turn them all. And it was really dramatic about it. And it was just absolutely wonderful. And
I thought that was like turning on the Christmas lights in Regent Street or something.
Yeah, it really was. But I mean, Jock was a proper Goldstone character. And like, he was.
I remember Jock very well. Yeah.
What a wonderful guy he was.
Absolutely. No, it's so yeah, I mean, it's I think you've just highlighted, I mean, not just the fact it was a last floodlit game 25 years ago. It's just there are so many things that are being commemorated about 25 years ago. But actually,
this was Barnet, wasn't it? That we
beat 1-0. Yeah,
and of course, every point was absolutely vital, as we know, at that time. So it was actually a very important match. It didn't, and
absolutely. But the weird thing is that after Fans United, which was February the 8th, we didn't actually lose at home again. That season. That's the bizarre thing. But actually, there's something else that occurs to me. As much as we're commemorating 25 years since the end of the Goldstone, it's actually something that you mentioned just now, Nick, is actually what's being forgotten is the 50th anniversary of our promotion from Division 3. Probably slightly unexpected promotion, admittedly, but, you know, we finished second to Aston Villa in the third division, finished just ahead of Bournemouth. There was only two went up automatically. And it's just something that's being overlooked, which
is an incredible sequence of results, you know, with loads and loads of last minute winners and come from behind wins. No, a real adrenaline rush, yeah. But probably, you know, a little bit playing above ourselves, as was shown by our instant relegation.
Absolutely.
But you know what? It's nice to remember in those days when we used to win at home all the time. And let's hope that we can get that feeling back again this weekend. Thanks to Alan Ware, thank you to Nick Trepanic. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with the brilliant old football shirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye.
Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner. you, mister. Told me I got what it takes. She said, I'll turn you on, son, into something strong. Play the song with the foggy break. And go-kart Mozart was checking out the weather charts, see if it was safe outside. And little early birdie came by in his curly whirly and asked me if I needed a down, but she never got tired. She's gonna make it to the night. She's gonna make it through.
Let the happy crash to the ground. Now sky through the slingshot, blinding fast.
touch is gonna make it through.